Earlier this week, towards the start of the week, I read a really nice article online by Kevin DeYoung. I sent the article out to those of you who get my sermons on email. The article's entitled, "The Case for Boredom." "I don't get bored as much as I should," he begins. Remember how boring life used to be? You'd wait in a line and just think, or sit on a plane and stare out the window, or relax on the couch and do nothing at all. I think of how much more my mind used to wander on walks and how I was better able to concentrate on books. I think of how bored I was on long car rides and at meals with adults, and yes, even in church. Of course, some boredom is just boring. But boredom also teaches us the discipline of sitting still and the invaluable lesson of being alone with our thoughts. Now, if you're brave enough, you can speak to me sometime about boredom in church. I can explain to you why I think it's a good idea from time to time and why I think it's good for our kids to be bored in church. So if that doesn't pique your interest, then maybe nothing will, but you're welcome to pick me up on that sometime. Now, Kevin DeYoung's real target in that article is not actually so much a case for boredom as it is a case for disconnecting. Here's what he says. We reach for our phones and our iPads first thing in the morning. We check them last thing at night. We check them at traffic lights. We scroll through them in the waiting room and in the queue. And when we have 10 minutes or maybe even just 2 minutes to kill, we thumb through Facebook or Twitter. I don't know what you think. I wonder if we've reached nearly epidemic proportions with that, checking phones, walking along. I think if an alien were to visit from Mars, perhaps they would think everybody had a glass screen glued to their hand, particularly when they're walking. Maybe that's something for us to think about in church. You can tell me afterwards what you think. Something on social media or use of devices. And I think when we stop and think about this, what we realize, what Kevin DeYoung is getting at, is that we are losing the ability to wait. I watched a video not long ago by a business consultant talking about millennials today. So it's a bit of debate about what a millennial is, but let's say a generation of people born in the 1990s onwards, early 2000s. Basically, a millennial is people reaching adulthood around now. And this business expert said that employers are finding this generation to be the hardest generation to put to work. This generation are arriving in the job interview, arriving newly into work, with the overriding feeling of entitlement. This generation know their rights, they think they deserve something now, today, and they want success in an instant. No one, he says, this business consultant says, no one is prepared for the long graft, the long hard graft. And in Christian terms, Bible terms, gospel terms, we might say this, we might put it like this, no one is prepared for the long hard obedience in the same direction. So there's another way of not just being bored in church, you can protest at church, can't you? People just don't know how to wait anymore. Think of the speed of Amazon Prime next day delivery. Can you live without that anymore? 3 days, 5 days delivery? And many of us have come to think, haven't we, that that kind of next day delivery is a basic human right. And what's it about to be replaced with? Amazon drone delivery, not just next day delivery, but next 20 minutes delivery dropped off in your backyard. Where will that leave us in our itch for the instant? How on earth are we going to fill those 20 minutes waiting for the package to be delivered? Kevin DeYoung says in that article, boredom provides the space for creativity, mental wandering, ponderings, and a lifestyle of prayer. Now that's the phrase that caught my eye, a lifestyle of prayer. I love that phrase. And I want us this evening to climb inside that phrase, a lifestyle of prayer, by seeing that that's what you see when you climb inside Psalm 123. What an incredibly short psalm, isn't it? Like I said, it's over just as we're getting going. We've cleared our throat, it's finished. I think almost because it's so short, we miss the details in it. There is a rich theology here of why God sees us, how he sees us, and who we are, and why we need his help, and what that help looks like. But actually in this psalm, there is one tiny little word that actually is where most of us are living today. We live inside this word, and it's so very, very difficult for us. So often it's where some of our biggest frustrations in life lie, and where your biggest frustrations lie. It's that little word right towards the end of verse 2. Our eyes look to the Lord our God till he shows us his mercy. We look to you until you show us mercy. What does until mean? 20 minutes? 20 weeks? 20 years? Well, who knows? I am doing something now until he does something. I'm doing this waiting for him. And here I am doing my waiting in 2017 in the midst of one of the most unable to wait generations there has ever been. We are some of the most impatient people on earth. Here is a psalm all about waiting long. Waiting when the wait is slow, boring, empty. Here's the thing that we're going to learn this evening, that even the most urgent prayers must learn to submit to the Lord's timetable. I've learned recently that some counselors say they never, ever respond immediately in a crisis. The text or the phone call, I'm not totally sure why they don't, but the path of wisdom seems to be that there is some benefit both to the person in crisis and the counselor in their relationship. There is some benefit in just waiting. I'll reply to your text in the morning. I'll reply to the email tomorrow. But how do we cope with that when we're the one crying out to God in a crisis? And God just seems to be saying to us, I'll get to you tomorrow, next year, 5 years. How do we wait long? Three things this evening in this lovely psalm to help us wait. Number one, feel the exhaustion. Feel the exhaustion. Shall we start at the end of the psalm? I think this will help us to see this because, look, it's really important that we don't think, well, look, my waiting today for God and his mercy is really difficult. What I have to contend with in my life is tough, and this chap didn't have it quite as hard as I have it. Verse 3, have mercy on us, O Lord. Have mercy on us, for we have endured much contempt. We have endured much ridicule from the proud, much contempt from the arrogant. Those two little words, if you're using the NIV like I am, much contempt, much ridicule, and then again, much contempt. Well, the idea of much is accurate, but our linguists tell us it's actually not forceful enough. It's true, but not the full force. So if you look at it again, the idea is that we are sated with contempt and ridicule. We have had more than our fill. We cannot fit any more onto us. You know that feeling when you've eaten more than you should? 20 minutes ago, you looked at that dinner and you were so hungry you thought you'd eat for weeks. And now you've eaten and eaten and you cannot physically fit anything more in. You push the plate away, not another mouthful. Our soul, the psalmist said, has had more than its fill of all these things. Sinclair Ferguson says, do you remember when you were little and you used to get in the bath and you used to get a sponge and you put the sponge under the water and you'd pull it up, completely sopping wet, you'd squeeze all the water out, do it again, put it under, bring it up. You've seen a sponge like that, haven't you? You cannot fit any more water in it. Every single pore filled. That's me. That's us, says the psalmist. There isn't a single bit left of me to cover in shame and contempt. There isn't one bit of us left that hasn't been stretched to breaking point. We've been pushed and pushed and mocked and ridiculed. And we can't take it anymore. I've had enough, Lord. How long, O Lord? Why me, Lord? Many commentators think that what's being described here in Psalm 123 is the situation when Nehemiah returned to Jerusalem and was attempting to rebuild the walls. They think this kind of psalm grew out of the exact opposition that Nehemiah faced. It's very plausible that verses 3 and 4 are not an abstract description, but describing a real life situation where God's people were pushed to breaking point. Just listen to this. You don't need to turn to this. Nehemiah chapter 2. When Sanballat, the Horonite, Tobiah, the Ammonite official, and Geshem, the Arab, heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you are doing, they asked. Why are you rebelling against the king? Chapter 4, verse 1. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews. And in the presence of his associates in the army of Samaria, he said, what are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from the heaps of rubble, burned as they are? What they are building, if even a fox climbed up on it, he would break down their wall of stones. See, just linger a little bit over those words in verses 3 and 4 in Psalm 123. That word contempt, you see, it's a word to treat someone of no consequence. You're worthless, and what you believe is worthless. You're crazy. No one could believe that. No sane person would think like that. Derek Kidner says that many words that people use bruise, but contempt, he says, is cold steel. Is that right? Have you felt it? At school, have you ever had someone mock you for being a Christian? You very likely will one day. It will happen. And it can be like a cold blade going right to your heart. What about the next word here? Ridicule. This is made a laughingstock. You don't really believe that, do you? No one thinks like that, you numpty. Ridicule from the proud, the next word. People who are at ease with themselves, so much so that they think they know best about everything. They're superior to you. They write their own rules and think everyone else should comply. Much contempt. What's the last word? From the arrogant. It's literally, arrogance is literally those who are lofty, high above, looking down condescendingly on others. You can't face life without praying about it, can you? I can get through, but you need a crutch. Me? I can handle it. Now, some of us are living with this. Some of you know exactly what this is like from friends, from family members, from school friends, from colleagues, from people you have come across. Some of us have lived with this. Some of us have no idea it's coming. Some of us know it's coming, and we're not sure how we will cope with it when it comes, or if we'll cope with it. So here's the question. How will we wait? How will we endure it when it comes? How do we live with unjust suffering? I think this is one of the key questions for every believer in every age, isn't it? For in every age of world history, it comes to God's people in so many different ways. Have mercy on us, Lord, for we are waiting. How do I keep waiting? Well, two more things. Number two, feel the exhaustion. Number two, enjoy the picture. Enjoy the picture. I think waiting here in the psalm has helped when we see a picture and when we see ourselves in the picture. Look how it works. Look what the psalmist does. Verse 1. We're going to come to this in the next point. Verse 1. I lift up my eyes to you. to you whose throne is in heaven. Now here's the picture, verse 2. As the eyes of slaves look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maid look to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God, till he shows us his mercy. What is the psalmist painting with his brush? He's painting here two bodily organs. You see that? Two bodily organs belonging to two different types of people. In the Old Testament, the eye is the organ of desire, and the hand is the organ of intervention, the organ of personal action. Remember Eve? She saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye. The eye is the organ of desire. It's how we want things. If your eye causes you to sin, Jesus said, pluck it out. And if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. The organ of personal action. Eyes desire, hands act. But now look, two bodily organs belonging to two different types of people. You see that? The eyes belong to the slave or to the maid, but the hand belongs to the master and the mistress. And look, one of those pictures is masculine and one of them is feminine. It's the Hebrew way of expressing totality. This is how, for all God's people, in every place, in every time, God is. This is what he's like. God is like this, both as a loving master and as a tender mistress. So look what the picture's showing us. Notice what you see when you look at it. You are not looking at a slave or a servant who are looking at their master's face. Did you notice that in the picture? They're not looking at their mistress's expression. Where are they looking? Looking at their hands. In the ancient world, leaders and commanders and kings and queens spoke a lot less than we do. They directed movements with their hands. They simply raised it, pointed it, flexed it, beckoned, summoned, opened. And the servant kept an eye on the hand, the organ of personal action, for the next movement. And that's the picture for us. I think in itself it's just an image for us to enjoy. It is a domestic scene. Don't be upset about the imagery of slaves or maids or masters and mistresses. This is a picture of warm relationship, of closeness. So let me finish with this. Here's the final thing. Feel the exhaustion. Psalmist has had enough. Can't take it anymore. Enjoy the picture. And here's my final point. Embrace the lifestyle. Embrace the lifestyle. For you see, this psalm intends to paint you and I into the picture. You see how that works? As the eyes of the slave, as the eyes of a maid look, as the eyes of a slave look, so our eyes look. As they, so we. Like they do, so we do. And what are the lessons for us as we look at their portrait? What kind of lives will we lead as we wait for God to act in mercy? Well, I very, very quickly want to give you five lessons. Here's five things to learn. Number one, learn who you are. Learn who you are. Many of our problems in life come with waiting, come from not knowing who we are. Who do you think you are, we say to the toddler, having a tantrum in the shop, or banging the table, screaming for their food, and they've only got 2 minutes to wait, but it feels like forever to them. Who do you think you are? If we don't say it out loud to them, we think it from time to time. You might be top dog at work this evening. You've made it to the top of the pile, or you're heading to the top of the pile. But in God's kingdom, who do you think you are? Comparison is everything, isn't it? Most men, if you play sport, tend to think you're God's gift to the game at some stage, football or rugby. Most men aren't shy in telling you that they're God's gift to the game. If you meet them in the pub, plenty of bravado about that epic five-a-side match. Goal-scoring record for the pub team. And as he's announcing all that and telling you what a great player, into the pub walks Wayne Rooney, or you're a rugby hotshot, and into the pub walks Johnny Wilkinson. What is that man now going to say about his footballing abilities in the presence of somebody like that? somebody greater, in the presence of someone greater, someone truly deserving of accolade, well, cold, hard reality sets in and the man realizes he's a past-it pub five-a-side footballer. If he's any sense, he'll pretty quickly feel, as a sportsman, pretty bankrupt. In the presence of God before him, who do we think we are? We are servants and he is master. Now make no mistake, our master is the best of masters. I call you friends, Jesus said. But we are friends of the master. It may not seem much, but just remember who you are as you wait and wait and wait. And that may begin to help you. It may just take some puff out of your chest. These words are from about 1,500 years ago. Listen to this. Humility consists in constant prayer combined with tears and suffering. Calling upon God prevents foolish confidence in our own strength and from putting ourselves above others. The more you call on God, the more you stop putting yourself above others. Number two, learn who God is. There's a lovely truth about God to embrace here. Verse 1, I lift up my eyes to you whose throne is in heaven. You have a king on a throne who rules the world. See, the point about lifting up my eyes, lifting up our eyes, is not a general one about looking up to God in heaven, but lifting them up to his throne. You are looking to the person who made the world with his words, and you're now looking to him to move his hand to help you. You have a king on a throne, but now look verse 2. So our eyes look to the Lord, our God. You have a king on a throne who is your king, your God. Alec Mateer puts it like this. He says, you whose throne is in heaven, verse 1, is a formal title. But now, verse 2, that same God is given a personal name. He's known by name and personally owned as yours. Charles Spurgeon said, the higher the Lord is, the better for our faith, since that height represents power and glory and excellence. That's what you get from a throne, isn't it? Power, glory, excellence, and all of those will be engaged on your behalf. He is our God. Tim Keller has that lovely phrase, doesn't he? The only person who dares wake up a king at 3 a.m. for a glass of water is a child. And we have that kind of access. Isn't that what this psalm is saying? The child who knocks on the king's door at 3 a.m. and he rises and gives and gets for the child what she wants. Learn who we are. Learn who God is. Number three, learn what to do. It's very simple here, isn't it? Look up. Look up. The uplifted eye here is a picture for prayer, isn't it? But it's describing a lifestyle of prayer, not a set time in the morning or the evening where you pray and that's it. I've had my quiet time. And now off I go for the rest of the day. Now this, again, look at the picture. It's the servant who does their daily work, going about their business, but is always looking for the master's hand. Always looking. This is prayer here that has become as natural and repetitive as breathing. This lifting eyes, a metaphor for praying. It's a picture of the servant always saying to God, I'm looking to you. Every single hour, every single minute, every single day. Number four, learn what to ask for. Learn what to ask for. We're very vague, aren't we, often in our prayers. You find that? Lord, bless them, help them, comfort them. But look, this is a prayer for divine action. It is for God to move his hand for action, for God to do something. Acts chapter 5, the believers gather together, and what do they pray? Lord, stretch out your hand. What are we waiting for this evening? A building together at some point in the future? Shouldn't we pray like this? Lord, stretch out your hand. Move your hand. You may be waiting for something this evening, maybe something that no one else knows you're waiting for. And this psalm says to you, in your waiting, keep looking, but keep looking for God to act, to intervene, to do something. Never stop asking Him to do what you want Him to do. John Piper says that in any one thing, God is doing 1,000 things. It's a wonderful, wonderful truth. In any one thing, God is doing 1,000 things. He is not idle. However you feel He's answering or not answering your prayers, in any one thing, God is working 1,000,000 things. And so ask Him to act for you in the ways that you want and need. I want to finish with this, number 5. Learn His timetable. Learn God's timetable. Here we are, verse 3, asking God for mercy, and He doesn't seem to be doing anything. We're looking at that hand, and it's just motionless. It's not moving. What are they asking for in verse 3? Mercy, because they are being ridiculed, mocked. I think we need to say this evening. This is what the whole Bible teaches us. There is a high cost to mocking the people of God. There is a high cost to mocking the people of God. It is not make-believe or pretend in Nehemiah, was it? It is not make-believe or pretend mockery for you today, perhaps, in your situation. You know how much it hurts. It is not pretend mockery today in Syria or Iraq or Mosul or North Korea. The hatred of Christ and the hatred of His people burns with a deadly white-hot intensity in many parts of the world. This here, Psalm knows it. This is opposition against God and against His chosen dwelling place in Jerusalem. This is rebellion against the one true King and His one royal throne. This Psalm knows that to rebel against the King is always, always a deadly serious matter. Whether you do it in Aberdeen, in a middle-class home with middle-class priorities, or whether you rebel against the King in Baghdad with a knife in your hand and murder in your heart, both of them are serious. Both of them might lead you to destroy God's people, which is to touch the apple of His eye. That is a place no one in all the earth should ever want to be, to harm those who are so precious to God that He sent His only Son to rescue them. God hears the prayers of His people for mercy. He hears your prayers, my prayers. He always hears and He always answers, even if His answers work to a different timetable than yours or mine. May that be the Trinity Church lifestyle. Men and women who know how to wait, not because we're looking for nothing, not because we're doing nothing, but because we're looking to Him. So keep looking. Keep asking. Never stop looking. Never stop asking. Amen.